years back, I was teaching a retreat. One of the people on the retreat asked, why is it that the Buddha assumes that everybody is basically good? And I had to correct the question. The Buddha never assumed that people are basically good. As he said, the mind is capable of all kinds of things, and it can reverse itself very quickly. So quickly that even he, who is a master of analogies and similes, had no adequate analogy for how fast it is to change its direction. But what he did assume was that we all want happiness. But as he said on the night of his awakening, he surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. He saw that everybody was on fire. We're looking for happiness through our passion, through our aversion, through our delusion. In other words, we're looking for happiness in the wrong places and in the wrong way. So we have to teach us that there's an alternative way of finding happiness that actually does lead to a genuine happiness, a happiness that doesn't change at all. The happiness is once you've gained it, it's there. Doesn't turn into anything else. That's the path we're on as we practice, the path to genuine happiness. But it requires that we see the suffering in the ways that we ordinarily look for happiness. After all, that's the Buddhist definition of the First Noble Truth, things we cling to, activities that we enjoy. We enjoy feeling and perception, and we enjoy fabricating our thoughts. We enjoy consciousness of the senses. And the idea that we could find happiness by not being passionate for these things, not clinging to these things, goes against the grain, because we've been clinging for who knows how long. So there's a lot in the message of the Buddha that goes against our expectations. And the question is, are we willing to change our expectations? To take him seriously when he says there is a cessation of suffering, and it is the ultimate rest, the ultimate refuge, harbor, safety, total freedom. Now to get there requires that we become dispassionate for the things that we have been looking for happiness in. This is where it goes against the grain. As we look for feelings of pleasure, we enjoy having perceptions about the world around us, making comments about the world around us. The mind's running commentary is one of its pleasures in life. You look back through history, in periods of time when people were really oppressed, that was their one way of counteracting the oppression, was criticizing the oppressor, maybe not to the oppressor's face, but being able to criticize inside. But the problem is that so many times the feelings we go for, the perceptions we go for, the ways we think actually cause us to suffer. Think about our habit of having a running commentary on the world around us. Comment on this. This is good. That's bad. This, I like this. I don't like that. This is right. This is wrong. With everybody commenting on everybody else, no wonder we have so much conflict. You don't have to look anywhere else, just look in the kitchen about metta. Everybody's commenting on everybody else. And everybody's causing themselves to suffer. So we have to look at the things that we're clinging to and to see that they're not worth it. Our passion for these things is what makes us suffer. Now, the Buddha's not telling us to just dry up and not have any desires at all. He says to focus your desires on the path. Be passionate for the path. It'll give you something to work on, because the mind likes fabricating things, so fabricate the path. put it together, like right now, meditating on the breath. The breath itself is a fabrication. There's an intentional element in there. That's what fabrication means. And if you want to run a running commentary, well, comment on the breath. How does it feel? Where would it feel really good to focus on the breath? What parts of the body seem to be especially sensitive to a really comfortable breath? Usually it's down the front of the torso. But some people find it down the back. Other people find it going deep into the brain. They're very sensitive spots inside the head where you breathe in, and it feels really good to get the breath energy all the way in there. So find your sensitive spots. And hold in mind whatever perceptions are helpful to get the breath really satisfying. So as you construct a path, learn to be passionate about this, trying to figure out your mind, because that's what the big issue is. We want happiness, but we do things that lead to suffering. And it's out of our ignorance, or as the John Sawat would say, it's out of our stupidity. We should be able to see that acts we're doing are leading to suffering. But we tend to blame the suffering on somebody else, somewhere else, something outside. Why is that? We're here to figure out our own minds. And that should be interesting. After all, seeing how the mind lies to itself, it's like a detective novel. Who committed the crime? And how did they cover it up? And the irony here is that the mind is lying to itself, right to its face. It does things here in the present moment, and then it disguises them. So we should be interested in how this happens, because after all, our happiness is at stake. There's some people who find the process of getting the mind into concentration really interesting. Other people find concentration easy, not so much of an issue. But then they get interested in more of the discernment side, figure out where their attachments are, why they're attached, what they can do to pry loose those attachments. But the important thing is you learn how to be passionate for the path. The Buddha talks about six things that you can take delight in that help you along the path. The first, of course, is simply delighting in the Dhamma, a teaching that focuses us in on where the real problem is and how we can solve it. It's amazing that such a teaching exists. What's also amazing is how many people want to change it, or to say, well, the Dhamma is just one person's opinion. There are many versions of the Dhamma out there, and none of them are totally true. That's delighting in the wrong thing. That's delighting in non-Dhamma. Delighting in the Dhamma means having a sense you have a reliable guide. It's been tested for 2,600 years now. And then you delight in abandoning and delight in developing. When you recognize that you've got something unskillful going on in the mind, you figure out how to get past it. Take delight in that. You're freeing yourself from your self-imposed shackles, the bonds that you place on yourself, and then delight in developing. You focus on the breath, and after a while you find yourself wandering off. Well, you come back. The next time around you try to stay longer, and you try to detect what it is, why it is that the mind leaves the breath. And you find that you can get your concentration more stable, more solid. Take delight in that. The Buddha talks about this in his instructions to Rahula, saying that when you see that you've done something that didn't harm yourself, didn't harm anybody else, take delight in that fact and continue practicing. Then the Buddha recommends delight in seclusion, which means both really liking it when you have some time by yourself, but then at times when you don't have time by yourself, you can learn how to get some seclusion inside. Again, take the kitchen as a test case. You can be with other people, but if you're not commenting on things all the time, there's a sense of peace inside. Because remember, the Buddha said we tend to go around with craving as our companion. We talk about the committee of the mind. That's what it is, the different forms of craving. If you can clear them out and have some quiet time inside, some solitary time inside, without your craving constantly making comments on things, you find you can be wherever you are and you can be happy. That old Zen koan about the sound of two hands versus the sound of one hand. I think that's what the koan is getting at. Something happens and we immediately slap a comment on it. That's two hands clapping. No wonder it's loud. But if it's just one hand, there's no sound. In other words, the event can happen, but you don't have to comment on it. Your craving doesn't have to get involved with it. And there's no suffering. So delight in seclusion, especially this inner seclusion. Then the Buddha recommends that you delight, what he calls non-affliction, or the unafflicted, actually. Now, that's a name for nibbana. And what you're delighting is the fact that you're on a path that goes to a place where there is no affliction. You're not afflicted. You're not imposing affliction on anyone else. True peace. True well-being. This is why when you think about the Buddha's teachings, always think about the Four Noble Truths, and in particular think about the Third Noble Truth. Because it's telling us there is this opportunity, there is a possibility. And if you learn how to have dispassion for your old ways of looking for happiness, there'll be genuine well-being. And then finally, the sixth object of delight is to delight in what the Buddha calls the non-objectified. Again, this is where you're not creating a sense of self around anything. And as a result, you're not creating any conflict. Another epithet for nibbana. And that's where we're headed, to a place where there's no conflict. Genuine well-being, no conflict. It's a good goal to have. So these are things you can be passionate about. And even if you don't get all the way to nibbana, try to be unafflicted in the way you behave. Impose no affliction on anyone else. And try not to get into conflict with yourself, conflict with others. Head in that direction. Our society tends to be very poor and teaching people how to live in harmony. Harmony inside, harmony with one another. But this is a good thing to be passionate about. How to find a harmonious balance inside yourself with the people around you. So the Buddha's not teaching you to be dried up. That's the image a lot of people have about dispassion. He's basically saying, focus your passion someplace else. Focus your passion in a way that's actually skillful, actually helpful, actually leads to a genuine happiness. And he points out the possibility of a happiness that lies beyond most of our imagination. We've heard the Four Noble Truths so many times. It's good to stop and reflect that these really are radical. They go against the grain. They're very counterintuitive. Because the duties with regard to the truths are what? First noble truth. Learn how to have dispassion. That's what comprehension means, the ending of passion, aversion, and delusion around your clingings. seeing that they actually do constitute suffering, and it's not worth it. The duty with the second noble truth, develop dispassion for it so you can abandon it. The third noble truth itself is dispassion. So we focus our passion on the fourth noble truth, which comes down to virtue, concentration, discernment. Although ultimately, as we complete the duty with regard to the truth, we fully develop it. We have to let it go too. But we let it go not out of disgust or aversion. Simply, we appreciate it. It's taken us to a really good place. It's done its work. But you don't need to do it anymore. I mean, passion is what drives all our actions. So focus your passion on the path, doing the path. Take delight in the fact that you're on a good path, leads to a good place. In the course of practicing the path, following the path, we do noble things. Then when we get there, then there's no need for passion because the happiness is totally complete in and of itself. So that's how you have passion for a dispassion. Let those thoughts energize you on the path.